Well, one of our keynote speakers at the March BizNews conference had a conversation with another of our keynote speakers at the conference next year, i.e. if you haven't booked yet, there's only like a third of the tickets left, so you better move. And Stafford Marcy will be picking up with us today about, well, the symbol that's on his cap. If you can't see that, of course, it's Bitcoin. So I got this message from Rob Herzog. He doesn't type. He sends you these video messages. And I thought he was showing off to start off with. I know he's in Tanzania. I don't know if he's on holiday or business or a combination of both. But he's at the beach. Combination. Okay. So he's at the beach and he says, I know you're talking to Stafford about Bitcoin later today. Yeah. This is what you got to ask him. So I guess the two of you have had some conversations.
Yeah, no, I think Rob's an amazing guy, and he's got a lot of South Africa's best interests at heart. I mean, he's very open-hearted. He speaks what he thinks and feels, and he's driven by just, you know, doing well for South Africa. So we've managed together to open up a couple of doors. It's nothing to announce or anything confidential right now that we can. It is confidential right now. We don't want to disclose anything, but we are leaning into certain aspects and people within government. And I think it's our responsibility to do that. We always look up to government, especially from an ICT perspective, a technology sector perspective. We complain, we say things about our government, but very few of us actually do the work. And doing that work is stepping up, opening up the doors and having the informal conversations and pulling some of the alarm bells to make them aware of what's happening on the outside. And Rob's been brilliant at that. And many people should recognize Rob for that. It's not just what he does on BizNews and his keynotes that are quite provocative. Rob leans into leadership in our country and really tries to bring them along. And what he does is he brings thought leaders, and I've seen him do that. And he brings them into the room. And so these conversations can be had. And these discussions can highlight some of the things that they may not see around the curve. And I really, really appreciate that. So he's done that a few times with me, and we're working on some significant projects. And we're just leaning in to make sure that South Africa does not get left behind, that South Africa is at the forefront of a lot of things, and that our leadership is aware of what's happening on the outside of their firewalls. I mean, that's the real thing that we're up to.
Yeah, if you're in government and you're just beavering away every day, you're on your treadmill, you're trying to do the best you can, you're not picking up what's going on necessarily globally. So who else is going to give you that insight but someone who's really well connected? And you are too, Steph. You've worked all over the world, and we know you could be working anywhere you want to, but you choose to also be here in South Africa. Big story at the moment is Bitcoin, and you dropped me a WhatsApp with quite a lot of also provocative stuff that I'll talk I'm keen to explore with you. But David Sacks, from an old Cape Town family, he left the country when he was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, but he's South African born, so we'll claim him. He is now the new Bitcoin or cryptocurrency and AI czar for the United States of America. He's been appointed by Donald Trump. Do you know the guy at all, or do you know what he's about?
No, so I know his history. I mean, when I was in the payments industry, I started a payments startup, and we were very deeply embedded in electronic payments, and we were so deeply embedded in that you start to understand who's the who around the world when it comes to payments. And obviously, David Sacks is part of the PayPal founders. You know, when Musk started PayPal, there's quite a few of them. There's Peter Thiel. You know, he was part of that, and Peter Thiel is actually in Namibia. Yeah. People don't know that.
He's a Namibian.
Yeah. He's got Namibia as a background. I think, maybe I stand on a correction, but I think that he's got Namibia as where he was born and where he was raised. And then you've got David Sacks, South African, and then you got Elon Musk. So there's a lot of South Africans. And David Sacks has a podcast, I think a podcast called All In. And it's a podcast that I listen to quite often. And he's quite vocal around, you know, Trump. He was very vocal around the Ukraine war. But I respect him for his technological views. But he approaches it from a venture capital perspective. And what's impressive is what Trump's doing. I mean, irrespective of what you think of Trump, the man, et cetera, he is coalescing and coagulating very interesting skill sets from an economic technology perspective inside the White House. I mean, these are thought leaders. These are people that really know what they're talking about. And Sacks is one of them. Sacks understands crypto. He understands he's an investor. He was an investor. He understands Bitcoin innately. There's recordings of him talking about the attributes of Bitcoin, why it's unique, its value proposition. And, you know, having that acumen inside of a legislative entity as powerful as the White House is very, very exciting. And I think it leans into where Donald Trump is going to be going here with some of these assets. I mean, his son got up this week at the Middle East and North Africa conference, the Bitcoin conference, and I think it was in Abu Dhabi. And he did a speech, and I actually shared that speech. Now, I'm not a fan of Eric Trump. I'm not a Donald Trump fan. Don't get me wrong. But what Eric Trump said on stage was quite profound. I listened to that speech from the beginning till the end, and my word, do they get Bitcoin? I mean, these are things that we've been saying forever. I mean, it was years ago that I got onto the Biz News stage for the first time and spoke about Bitcoin, and 99% of the audience had never heard of it and had never traded with it, etc., all the way to now seeing people like Jerome Powell talking about Bitcoin, you know, just I think this week or last week, saying it's akin to gold. And he compares it to the attributes that gold has, but it's digital gold. Profound. Putin comes out on stage this week and talks about Bitcoin being immutable and not being able to put. And then, you know, Eric Trump gets up on stage. And if any, go listen to that speech. And that will give you some insight into what Trump is going to be doing with these assets when he's in power. And one thing that we've very focused on is whether he will move from saying he's going to have a Bitcoin reserve pile, those are his words, and whether that will translate into a strategic Bitcoin reserve asset that sits within the Federal Reserve and that's utilized for all the attributes that it will be utilized for. If that should occur, I think that's quite profound. And Eric Trump, for me, lifted the lid on that more so than anyone else did, because he spoke about his dad. He spoke about Bitcoin's value proposition as a strategic asset. He spoke about it being digital gold. He spoke about the store value attributes of it. He spoke about all the things that we've been saying for years and years as Bitcoin maximalists. He was saying that on stage. And he kept on talking about his dad implementing that and personifying all of that within the context of the United States. And as a South African, first of all, as a Bitcoin maximalist, I'm extremely excited. That is extraordinary. As a hodler, as someone that's spoken about this asset forever, finally the world is waking up to what it is. And it's glorious. We're loving it. As a South African, I'm petrified. I'm very, very concerned. Why am I concerned? I'm concerned because our leadership don't fully comprehend what this is. They still consider it as an asset, you know, coin go up, coin go down. And unfortunately, we've got so many of these other little crypto token things all around that are flashy and volatile, and they attract everyone. And I want to differentiate from that. So I don't speak for the crypto industry. I speak for Bitcoin as a Bitcoin maximalist. And if you take a look at Bitcoin and you consider what Trump could potentially do here, so let's think about that for a second. What Trump could do within the first couple of months, he could move the confiscated Bitcoin that sits under the auspice of the FBI right now, and that's over 200,000 Bitcoins. He could move those assets into the Federal Reserve, and they could be reclassified as a strategic reserve asset. He could bring to pass Senator Loomis's bill, and the bill is very simple. The bill says we should create and establish a Bitcoin strategic reserve, number one. Number two is we should buy 1 million Bitcoin over 5 years. Number three is we will not touch that Bitcoin for a minimum of 20 years, right? And if we do touch it, we'll touch it to pay off the national debt. Now, if you take a look at all of this noise happening and you see states in the United States, I think it's Wyoming, that has announced a strategic Bitcoin reserve, and we're going to hear more and more of this happening on a state level in the United States. If this all comes to pass, I sit in a country as a South African and I'm watching this. And this reminds me of Blockbuster with Netflix and the internet. This reminds me of newspapers when they said the internet's just a fad. This reminds me when people said open source software is nothing. I think we now have a national state emergency on our hands. I think if we see the world, which Trump is possibly doing, moving away from a global gold standard, and they start sunsetting that and they move towards a global digital gold standard, what does that mean for South Africa? That should scare the living. I mean, that should really, really stop us as leaders. And this is what Rob and I are trying to do right now. And we are engaging with some very smart people. I mean, David Masondo and some of these people in finance in South Africa, some of the smartest people I've met. I mean, they are really smart. Our finance minister, I know that Rob speaks to him and we're engaging with them. Enoch and David and these names, these are really, really smart people. And they, what's beautiful is they're listening. And they're giving us the audience to educate them and to deal with their questions. And the reason we're doing this is because Rob and I right now, and thank you to Rob, and thank you for the ministers that are listening and the departments that are listening, we are pulling the alarm bells. And we're saying, hey, we may be completely wrong here, but if we are right, we could, in the next 24 to 36 months, be in a very dire economic situation should BRICS decide to weaponize gold, which America feels that they are doing. So Russia and China are exiting U.S. treasuries, and they're buying gold bullion like mad. That's weaponizing gold. I mean, Trump has the chess pieces on the table, and unfortunately, the pawns that they are playing don't compare to the queens and the castles and the rooks and things that Donald Trump has, which is he could demonetize gold to a certain extent. He could print money to buy more Bitcoin. He could reclassify the Bitcoin that he has. He could push the Bitcoin price through the roof by doing that. He could become the largest stakeholder. He could own around 5% of the Bitcoin network forever. If he did that, what does that mean for South Africa, where we sit right now? We don't have a Bitcoin strategic reserve play. We're still coming to terms with what Bitcoin is.
You always go quickly and you always need a little bit of a, you know, put a bit of brakes on there. So let's just go back a little bit. And it's a very, very important point that you make here. Countries have got reserves. America, 72% of its reserves, I did a little bit of homework, so I didn't just suck that out of my thumb, are in gold. So that's 8,133 tons of America's national reserves are sitting in gold. That's worth about $500 billion. So $500 billion.
So that's about 5% of global supply.
Okay. Of gold. No, that's more than that. I mean, the gold supply.
About 16 trillion asset in the world. $16 trillion asset in the world. Yeah. So they own how much?
Okay. So let's just go through the situation where we are. So America's got 8,133 tons. South Africa has got 173 tons. So we're tiny. America's got 72% of its assets in gold. South Africa, 16%. So although we used to mine a lot of gold, we used to do 1,000 tons a year in 1970. We only do 100 tons now. We down there with Uzbekistan and just slightly behind Indonesia. We have fallen a long, long way, primarily because of really poor mining legislation, because a lot of gold in the ground, but we still are in it's still relevant, but it's not that relevant. But more relevant from what you're saying now, Steph, is that if America decides that it's going to switch those 8,133 tons of gold, which is huge, $500 billion worth, into Bitcoin, well, it's going to depress the gold price flat out, big time. And on the other hand, it's got to do something to the Bitcoin price. But why? Why would it do that? What did Eric Trump say at the speech? And what did David Sacks say in his various podcasts that makes you think that that is a direction they could be moving in?
Well, first of all, I think they all recognize that it's an incredible store of value. It is better than gold. I mean, gold bugs will come at me, but you know, for me, it's a shining piece of useless metal. And it's got flaws to it in terms of divisibility, in terms of portability, in terms of ownership, etc. It is, you know, I have a 24-year-old and a 21-year-old. They never want to own gold. They want to own Bitcoin. You know, so why? Because of its divisibility, the fact that it's portable, its immutability, its sovereignty, its the ability that its instantaneous aspects of it all. It is a better store of value. Its attributes just completely outpace gold. And it's proven that it is a true store value. And I think a lot of people may comment on this video that they don't understand Bitcoin and say, yeah, but it's not. You know, it's going to go to zero. I mean, Rob's getting that a lot at the moment, where very prominent businessmen are sending him messages saying it's rubbish, it's going to go to zero. And I just, you know, I saw this how many times in my career, and I've said it on previous podcasts, where people think it's free and open source, it's going to go away, etc. So it is a store value, and leadership in the world is starting to recognize that it is a true store value. David Sacks has made noise about this. Eric Trump on stage had made it very clear that its attributes are unique, that it is incredibly valuable as a strategic asset to the United States, and its value proposition as a reserve is obvious. You know, if you take a look at the issue that they have as a country, I mean, $35 trillion of debt, right? You take a look at that. How are they going to mitigate that debt? You know, inflation, taxation, GDP growth, I doubt
it's the only way to do it. You wipe out debt either by reflating or by taxing people more heavily, both of which are just not on the table right now. So how do you address it? Yeah.
Exactly. And then you take a look at the geopolitical shifts that are happening. You know, BRICS making the noise that it's making, threatening the United States. De-dollarization is a thing. So when you take a look at where the United States is sitting right now, I think this is a smart move. You know, because I think the world is weaponizing gold against the United States for many reasons that may be legitimate. Yes, their debt is extraordinary. Yet we're still on the dollar standard. It is still the currency that everyone in the world defaults to. And we're not going to get away from that anytime soon. So I think with the chips that they're sitting on the table right now, it makes complete strategic sense considering their debt, considering the economic situation, considering the opportunity that it presents. Because if they should do this, move Bitcoin into their strategic reserve that they've confiscated, agree that they're going to buy 1 million Bitcoin, there'll be a run. There'll be a price. Bitcoin will run, right? And I think what we'll see is Bitcoin will start etching into the gold market. I think it will completely go after the $16 trillion gold market because we will see other countries having to do the same. Now, there's another element of this, and that is stable coins. You know, the United States still needs to mature its legislation from a stablecoin perspective. That's essentially issuing out a digital dollar. So what they could do is they could attract people like Tether, Circle. These are people that issue out stablecoins that are backed by U.S. treasuries. So it's a one-to-one to the dollar, but it creates a digital dollar that has the same attributes of a cryptocurrency that moves fast, instantaneously. You know, it has the conversion capabilities without the cost. So if they moved and mature their legislation and move those stable coins into, and they created a legitimate dollar, audited, recognized, legislated stable coin in the United States, those two moves could make the US dollar for the next, our lifetime, it could re-energize the dollar and make it the global reserve all over, double down on its global reserve status right now in a very, very big way. And geopolitically, I mean, it's the ultimate checkmate.
So what does that mean for South Africa? Let's now start. Okay, let's just say what Rob suggested. Rob suggested, let's make Stafford Marcy the David Sacks of South Africa. He said, let's go and put you into that position. I don't think David Sacks is going to go to work in Washington every day, but he is certainly going to be educating people and helping them and shaping the policy as it goes forward. What if Stafford Marcy was the David Sacks of South Africa?
We have the David Masandos of South Africa. They are equally capable. They are smarter. They have political acumen. They understand this from a broader context than technologists like myself do. And what we need is for folks like that to give us the platform to listen to us. And we will help them. There is enormous political capital in cutting the Bitcoin ribbon, announcing the Bitcoin strategic reserve. There is enormous political capital in that from a South Africa brand perspective, technological perspective in every way. And our job is not to usurp these folks. They're smarter than we are. It's to lean in. And that's what we're doing. So I want to do that. And we will continue to do that. We're on WhatsApp groups with them. We are on phone calls with them. We are going to be in-person meetings with them. They are listening. So I'm very, very excited. But I'm excited because we're being listened to. I'm panicking because I think we need to move faster. So what could it mean for South Africa? I think this could be a beautiful thing for us. Establishing a Bitcoin reserve doesn't just mean we move our gold into Bitcoin. It's a broader play. It says, you know, let's take a look at Bitcoin mining. You know, why can't we generate our own and earn our own Bitcoins? So take a look at our assets like Eskom. Eskom has a huge debt issue. You know, it establishing a Bitcoin reserve for its curtailed power, its renewable energy projects. It's got sterile projects that don't have business cases that could bring forward a wind farm or a PV implementation. You put a Bitcoin mine and attach it to one of those things, the business case accelerates it and brings it forward 10 to 15 years, you know, and they could mine Bitcoin. And with that Bitcoin, they could convert it into fiat currency, but they could start establishing a Bitcoin reserve, a strategic asset reserve for us as a country with just the power that's wasted. We waste in this country. I mean, I've heard anything from 25, believe it or not, to 35% of the power on a daily basis. Why? Because there's this very simple thing called the duck curve, right? So you and me in the morning, we plug all our devices in, our shavers, we're showering, our geysers, utilization's very high. That's the tail of the duck. Then during the day, we go to work and there's a collapse in power utilization. That's the belly of the duck. Then we go home and then we get to the head of the duck and then of the beak. And that's our peak utilization at night. In winter, electric blankets, it's geysers again, etc. So we have amplitudes that are quite extreme in the graph, right? Now, the problem that we had before was that the grid took strain because a lot of us didn't have solar. So the duck's belly was very shallow. So it wasn't very deep. So the utilization peaks year and year, the dip below was very shallow because we'd still go to work and we were still using Eskom power and we were still doing all of that. Now, we have gigawatts of installed solar and PV on homes, in businesses, etc., which means the utilization has collapsed. And that collapse is going to continue collapsing. So the problem for an energy generator is how do you maintain the grid stabilization because you've got these intense fluctuations from usage peaks to troughs at night, etc. Plus, you've got all those renewable projects adding onto the duck belly. So we've got PV installations. We've got wind farms that we need to go live. The problem is demand. The demand is not consistent. The demand is erratic. And sometimes the demand doesn't even exist initially because you have to build the transmission lines and get it to distribution to ultimately get it to the consumer. You slap a Bitcoin mine onto a PV plant, it's an instantaneous buyer on site. It settles you and pays you in real time, same day. They don't have someone that can consume. They don't have a power buyer, purchaser that can consume all that energy so instantaneously. And when they want to take it back, give it back to them instantaneously and settle them instantaneously too. This could become the most beautiful EAP story, environmental impact lighthouse, taking our assets in the country and utilizing those assets to start building up this Bitcoin reserve. So this is not about going off and printing money to buy Bitcoin or taking out gold and immediately converting it to Bitcoin. This is putting a strategy together that's a composite of multi-dimensional attributes of the country and saying, how can we build this up? How can we become a player here? And I think this is when you need to understand Bitcoin much more than just coin go up, coin go down. You need to understand how the protocol works, proof of work. Why it's great at energy consumption. Why does more than 55% to 65% of Bitcoin mining in the world is done with renewables, with green energy. It makes those business cases work in the world today. So people say Bitcoin mining takes up so much power. Yeah, it does. Amazing. We want it to. We want our money, our hard money, to be attached to physics and energy. That's what makes it hard. That's what makes it indestructible. That's what gives it its attributes. But because of that and the technology behind it, it has the ability to stabilize grids, lessen the duck curve, create economic prosperity for alternative energy providers. That play still needs to play itself out in South Africa. And that's where Rob and I are leaning in again very deeply. So he and I are having deep conversations with leadership in those areas to say, hey, guess what, guys? It's not just about wheeling energy or doing something green over here. If you don't have a Bitcoin mining strategy within your alternative energy execution, your business cases just don't stack up. And even if they do, it's going to take too long.
Just explain what Bitcoin mining is and why that would be so relevant here.
Okay. So think about it for a second. When we talk about Bitcoin mining, this is, for lack of a better term, this is transaction process. This is when every 10 minutes, this thing, this protocol, every 10 minutes, it takes a block of transactions and then it melts those block of transactions into this ledger. And this ledger is quite a big ledger. So you have a global transparent ledger that all of us can take a look at. That's the Bitcoin blockchain. Now, every 10 minutes, it takes all the transactions that were done and then it shoves it in there. And to do that requires a lot of energy, a lot of computing power to do that processing. And the way that computing power happens in the world is completely decentralized. So you've got Bitcoin miners all over the world. You've got Bitcoin nodes all over the world that put up their hand when a transaction needs to be processed like that. And they say, hey, I'll do it. And the folks that win are the folks that have the most compute with the cheapest energy, right? So they can solve that little algorithmic puzzle piece quicker, and then they get the reward. So every time you solve this, you get issued Bitcoins, okay, as a reward for completing the transaction. So that is energy intensive. But people were arguing against Bitcoin for many years, saying that energy intense, every time you do something, every time you pay with Bitcoin, do you realize the implications for the planet, how bad this is, etc. What they didn't realize was what was happening with Bitcoin miners in the background is that Bitcoin miners, Robin and myself, have established an entity, which we don't want to disclose just yet, and it's a Bitcoin mining entity. And what we're doing is we're running around to energy generators, alternative energy providers, and we're saying, hey, guess what? We'll take your energy. We'll put a Bitcoin mine. And now, what is a Bitcoin mine? It's a little machine called an ASIC. I'm not going to get into the technicalities of it, but it's a purpose-built machine for Bitcoin mining. So you can cluster these up, and you can put them into a container. You can put them in a football field plant size. There's massive deployments of this all over the world. And you attach it to an energy grid. Now, if you take a look at like a hydroelectric plant, I mean, it's incredible. The global standard for energy wastage or curtailment is around 35 to 40%. Believe it or not, of the energy that we produce in the world, we lose almost half of that every day, simply because demand doesn't exist in the evenings or demand is erratic. Bitcoin is the ultimate hyena. It is the ultimate vulture. It wants that curtailed power. It wants that wasted power. And when you attach it to your grid, its ability to settle you for the power that it utilizes instantaneously is a beautiful thing. And the ability for you to have an on and off switch. So literally we can give Eskom, or we can give NAM Power, or we can give any one of these energy regulators a big fat switch that says, okay, on Bitcoin, take, give it to Bitcoin because we can't use it. And that Bitcoin mine will take all the energy that you can give it that would have gone into the ground 30 meters deep and just been eradicated. Now the Bitcoin mine is eating all that up, generating Bitcoins. And then when you want it back, you hit the red button and you got all your power back again. There is no power consumer that has those attributes in the world. A smelter can't do that on and off switch. And it can't settle instantaneously like that. And it can't do it on site with mobility included. So the beauty of South Africa is, with our power in this country, with Eskom, we could rejuvenate Eskom. We could reinvigorate and make the business cases for all of these alternative energy providers in the country. We could accelerate their business cases. We have funds that the World Bank and everyone wants to apply to Eskom to exercise it. It has been incentivized to work with private producers like us to implement things and to get off coal. Guess what? If you want to get off coal, South Africa, very quickly, I'll give you one answer. It's not wind. It's not solar and PV. It's wind and Bitcoin. It's solar, wind, and Bitcoin. You put the and Bitcoin in there, the economics change completely. And I think that is a strategic value proposition for that industry. But I think when you think about it at a nation state level, and you look at the geopolitical winds that are blowing right now, I think it is important for us to have these discussions right now to say, what are we doing about our South African national Bitcoin strategic reserve? We need to have a story.
But there are lots of people who haven't read the Bitcoin standard, who haven't read the fiat standard, who haven't listened to Stafford Marcy, who didn't get it. Even today, if the Bitcoin price falls, there will be many celebrating. I told you so. I told you it was rat poison, as Charlie Munger said. I told you it's rubbish.
Yeah.
That penny has to drop first. And I'm afraid that as much as David Masondo and Enoch Godongwana are listening to you and Rob, they are being inundated by those who are saying, use a parallel in my industry, of course newspapers are going to last forever. Of course people like to read out of a newspaper. What's this internet thing that is more efficient in delivery? Gold is the place to be because I can feel it, I can touch it, I can hold it in my hand. I can't hold Bitcoin in my hand.
That's leadership.
There's many of those arguments. So how do you argue? Leadership. How do you respond to that?
That's leadership. That's leadership. So leadership has to immerse itself, listen, and take bold steps. And I think it's an opportunity for us to take bold steps here. We are either going to do this right now or we're going to be forced to do this later. And we are not doing it because we're excited about the Bitcoin price being $100,000 or we're excited about, that's not why we're doing it. We think this is an asset class that has already proven itself technologically. Over the last 15, 16 years, it has not been hacked. It has beautiful attributes, which I've just described from an energy consumption perspective. The technicalities of that is clear. We also have on the table clear economic indicators. We've never seen ETFs perform like this in the history of ETFs. We have never seen a flight of capital into this asset at the speed at which it's going. We've never seen this before. If you took a look at just the BlackRock IBIT ETF, I mean, its performance is extraordinary just in the last 6 to 9 months. They've never seen
performance like that. Explain that. What is the BlackRock IBIT ETF?
Well, think about it before. And this is quite what I love about Bitcoin is you and I could buy it before Microsoft could buy it. You and I could buy it before a government could buy it, right? I mean, it's just extraordinary. A government could confiscate it, but they couldn't buy it because we could get into the network ourselves and in a sovereign, immutable way, we could gain access to this asset, which is such a beautiful thing. What was needed was more rails to enable this asset class to be purchased. So if you take a look at what BlackRock has done, BlackRock has essentially put those rails in place. So IBIT is a spot Bitcoin ETF, and it allows you to go and buy as a business or an organization. You buy IBIT, and that gives you exposure directly to Bitcoin, which BlackRock takes full custodial ownership and responsibility for. Now, Bitcoin maxis would say it's not true because it goes to Coinbase and all that, but that's not the point. The point is a business can gain exposure to Bitcoin by buying the BlackRock ETF, which is, its ticket symbol is called IBIT. We've got many others. But if you take a look at the amount of institutional capital, the billions and billions that has poured into this asset, it's very, very clear. You know, if you take a look at what's on the table, what's happening in the world. So I think the argument maybe 12 months ago, 24 months ago would have been a little bit more difficult. But I don't think we have anything standing in our way right now to prove that what we're saying is legitimate, that the concern is data-driven. It's not emotive. It's not even economic emotion at all. This is a legitimate national security issue, in my opinion. I think, and that's what I've been saying. I've been pulling the national security, do something lever, all the time over the last couple of days.
But there are still many people who believe that Bitcoin is going to collapse. It's going to go down to zero. What we did was we listened, even Piet Viljoen, and Piet actually tells me in a recent interview that he buys Bitcoin every month, which is interesting because there's your ultimate value investor. We put 2 years ago, 2% of the BizNews SHIFT portfolio into Bitcoin. The only thing we could get then was something called ProShares, which was a terrible investment because it paid our dividends every month. Anyway, that's all we could get, and a company called MicroStrategy, which was an amazing investment. Anyway, what's happened is that 2% of a good performing portfolio is now 10%, and we've sold MicroStrategy and ProShares, and we've put it into exactly that thing that you're talking about, the IBIT. In other words, you are buying Bitcoin. So whatever happens to the Bitcoin price, the ETF, the exchange traded fund of IBIT, will be influenced accordingly. But by doing that, there are many saying it's high risk. How can you have 10% of your portfolio? I argue that, well, we only put in 2%, so we're just letting that 2% ride. How do you answer those people who are saying to you, what percentage should I have in Bitcoin? And is it very high risk to have 10% there?
I think risk high, low is dependent on your personal situation. I mean, my generic advice is you put what you can into Bitcoin that you can afford to not touch for 4 to 5 years at minimum. If you don't want to touch it in 4 to 5 years, it's a great place to store value. If you have the ability to not touch it for 10 years, incredible. If you want to leave intergenerational money, where else would you store it? I mean, we're in the world today. So the folks that always come at us with the Bitcoin's going to zero perspective, I always just turn that the other way around. And, you know, I think the dollar's going to zero. And I can fundamentally show you how, just based upon inflation, its value declining on average around 5% a year. you know, you put your stuff into real estate, I can show you that that's not a great investment. I can prove to you that every other asset class in the world has risk associated with it, doesn't give you sovereignty, this just doesn't give you the payback. So the counter argument, there's one stat and one stat alone, you know, more than 80% of the dollars in circulation today were printed in the last 4 years. You know, debasement is a fact. We have too much money floating around in the system. Governments and central banks doing what they're doing and the behavior. And the beauty of Bitcoin is that it makes us all look at what is money. More so than any time before. I've never seen my children understand money because of Bitcoin as well as they do. They understand the history of money, what is money. And I think that that population education that's happening is a beautiful thing. So yes, will it take time? Are people saying this thing's going to go to zero? The internet was going to go away. You know, a free and open source software was never going to be a thing. I've seen this before. The point is, don't look at it through your skeuomorphic economic lens. The problem with Bitcoin is it shows that the emperor has no clothes. You know, it actually makes an economic mind, you know, it draws them down. It really does. And it takes them back to first principles. And you've got to take your ego out the way, and you really got to look at it with full humility and to understand exactly what it is. You've got to do the work and don't invest. Don't touch it until you've done at least, in my opinion, 100 hours of work. Go read, go study, go listen to the podcast, go in depth, listen to the alternate views, but do your own work. You know, don't just look at the headlines and then form an opinion based upon your skeuomorphic economic views and overlay that on top of Bitcoin. But I mean, once you get it, I've never met anyone that finished the Bitcoin standard that came back and told me, nah, this thing's not going to go anywhere, or this thing's nothing. You read the book, The Bitcoin Standard, or even Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money. Those two books, if you've read that and you can come back to me and say Bitcoin's nothing, and it's I'll be shocked. I've never seen that. And out of the entire business tribe that's ever read that book, I don't know of anyone that believes that this thing is not an asset class of value, or that its attributes are not what we say. And the beauty of it is, we're talking about it, and guess what? It has no head office. It's got no CEO. It's got no board of directors. It's got no chief marketing officer. It's just a thing that works every 10 minutes, and it doesn't care what Alec thinks, Stafford thinks, David Masondo thinks, Cyril Ramaphosa thinks, or Donald Trump thinks. It doesn't care. And that's the beauty of it. It just does what it does, immutable, sovereign, and incorruptible. I mean, Putin said that. This week, he got up on stage and said, it's something that cannot be switched off. You can't interfere with it.
We know that from time immemorial, people have given a value to gold. Now they're giving a value to Bitcoin. There seems to have been a tipping point. When do you think that was reached? Because for the president of the United States, of the country that's a quarter of all economic activity, to say Bitcoin is a legitimate asset class in the same way as today everybody would say gold, because it's been around for so long. When was that tipping point? When did Bitcoin become this digital gold?
I think it's always been that. I don't think we've reached our tipping point yet. I think we're still 0.2% of global assets. Of a $900 trillion base, we're still only 0.2%. I think the tipping point still isn't there. I think we've seen little sparks of it. I think MicroStrategy and what Michael Saylor's doing. We take a look at what, you know, BlackRock's doing with IBIT. We take a look at, you know, the fair accounting rules that are about to come to pass. I think there's still some things that need to happen. But I think we very much, as close as we are, I mean, for me, they were like, I'm not going to go too far back, but in 1971, when Nixon said, no more the gold standard, right? He ripped the dollar away and he made that proclamation. That proclamation to me was equal in magnitude as when in 2008, the United States bailed out all the banks, right? And both of those were negative for you and I. Those things were not good for humanity.
Again, yeah. Just slow down a little bit, because up until 1971, until Nixon did that, you could take a dollar, theoretically, and go to the United States Central Reserve and say, I want to swap this for gold. It might be a tiny fraction of gold, but there was a backing to the US dollar. When Correct. Nixon tore it up, there's no more backing. So it is really, if you think about it, the same way as people believe gold has got value, the same people would believe that the dollar has value. But the problem with the dollar is that there's a heck of a lot of them that have been created, as you explained a bit yep. earlier. So it's devaluing continuously. So I kind of get all of that. But what about the big threat to Bitcoin? And that is quantum computing. We've had an announcement this week or in the past week that Google is now going to be bringing out the first quantum computer. I've seen in Davos the those who are at the forefront of this technology. Everything that told me said that they said was it's going to take a heck of a long time. But they did say that once quantum computing is with us, it will put things like Bitcoin at risk because it would be able to crack any algorithm. What's your take on that?
Talk about tipping points. But let me just finish on the tipping point thing. I think the tipping point will come. We had 1971 Nixon. We had 2008 banks being bailed out. I think one of the biggest tipping points in our lifetime may happen next year. If Trump announces a strategic Bitcoin reserve for the United States, I think that's on par with what Nixon did in 1971 in magnitude, on par with the positive impact that it will have on the United States and the entire world. I think it,
so it goes the other way around, if you like. They dropped the gold standard. Now they're bringing in a Bitcoin standard.
Hard money. Okay. The hardest money known to mankind in the history of mankind will now become the substrate. And I think that will be a beautiful thing. I think there are some geopolitical concerns, and I've pulled the alarm and I've unpacked that now earlier. Now, the question is, okay, but what's the risk with this thing, right? So with gold, in my opinion, gold isn't rare. Gold is just difficult to get out of the ground. But like El Salvador announced that they found more gold. I think another in Africa the other day, one of the African countries announced that they found huge amounts of gold. There's tons of gold around. The only problem is we can only take about 1-2% of it out of the ground consistently since its existence because of the technology. That's fine. All right. But it's not scarce. It's difficult to extract. Right. I think there was a story around, I think it was, who was the French revolutionary? That and Peter Diamandis alludes to him in his book Abundance, and he says that when we couldn't extract, the bauxite, the ore, we couldn't extract the metal out of that, it made, you know, silver more valuable than anything else on the table. But when the technological increment came and we unleashed, then the abundance came and it became something that was just common, right? So when you apply technology to anything, you establish an abundance. Now, the question around quantum computing is similar. If we have this quantum computer, can we just train this thing on the Bitcoin cryptography? Now, the Bitcoin cryptography, it's got like two aspects of its cryptography. It's got this thing called elliptic curve, which I won't go into, and it's got this other thing called SHA-256. Now, these are a methods of it using keys to lock and unlock the blockchain. Now, to hack those, brute force, could you do it, etc.? The argument is with this Willow that Google's announced that now has the computing power to do it. Here's my counter argument. My counter argument, first of all, is the way Bitcoin works. If we have quantum computing, we will have quantum cryptography. And when we have quantum cryptography, we will easily fork and implement that within the context of the blockchain. So we'll move from the quantum computing that we have now that is the cryptography that we have now that is not quantum computing enabled, and we'll move towards a quantum computing enabled derivative of the Bitcoin blockchain network.
Okay, got it.
Right, right. Yeah. That's the quick answer. The more broader answer is, if you've got a quantum computer that can hack the Bitcoin network and it has that power and capability, why would you go for 0.2% of the global market? Why would you not train it on every single bank, on every single Federal Reserve, on every single database in the entire world? I think Bitcoin is the smallest fruit on the tree right now. So I think if that power did exist, number one is, I don't think Bitcoin is as valuable to the person that can exercise it. I think there's a bigger set of assets. And number two is, if you exercised it from a legality perspective, we'd know where to come find you because there's only one of them in the entire world. We'd know that it was executing. We'd see the energy signature. We'd see the data flows. we could go to Google and we could lock up the entire Google and shut it down, etc. So, you know, people argue it in this non-practical way. This is a big quantum computer, and then there's this maniac sitting behind it, and he'll train it on Bitcoin, and he'll grab and soak up all the Bitcoins. Yeah, so if we did that, we'd go find him, because one of those things are really, really big. The energy signatures are profound. It's extremely expensive. And even then, because they've done this, we can kind of articulate and start creating quantum-based cryptography, which we'll implement inside the blockchain. And there's a way to do that. Hmm. That's the answer.
Yeah, I like that. I did hear it being explained another way, in that you'd need 1 million qubits to crack the code, and the Google computer's got like 100 qubits. So it's a heck of a long way to go before it can get to that point. There are a couple of other questions that I'm really keen to get your insights on. This week, Microsoft voted down a proposal from its shareholders to consider having Bitcoin in its strategic reserve. What does Microsoft know that we don't know? And I say it, its board of directors voted it down.
So I think we need to peel that a little bit. I think it wasn't all the Microsoft shareholders that had that opinion per se. I think it, you know, if you take a look at the trending of their board, usually when the board states that this is its opinion, its shareholders generally go with it. So I think there may be some herding here versus, you know, everyone decided Bitcoin's bad, therefore we're not going for Bitcoin. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is take a look at the knock-on effect of that, since they've declined doing that, establishing a Bitcoin strategic reserve for Microsoft. There's been a lot of negative sentiment. I mean, there's a lot of noise about that. And I love what everyone says. You get the Bitcoin price that you deserve. You know, my issue with Microsoft, people think Microsoft is so innovative. My issue with Microsoft is not that. Microsoft is not innovative. Microsoft wasn't the first to the browser. They weren't the first to the Office package. They weren't the first to the internet. They weren't the first to anything. This is not a company that's the first to anything. So don't think about them in that way. Don't think about them as this pioneering technological leader. No, they're not. They weren't the first to cloud computing. In general, Microsoft is usually a laggard, but they catch up very, very quickly. So I do think, in my opinion, in the next 24 to 36 months, especially if Donald Trump does what he does, especially if we see keep seeing more and more people doing this, I think we should watch what Amazon's going to do. It's going to be interesting. You know, will Amazon do it? Because they've announced that this is part of what their shareholders and their board will now be discussing at their next AGM. I think it's coming up. Let's see. You know, I think if Amazon does it, that'll be interesting. But I think we need to calm down a little bit. I think there's a lot of noise around Bitcoin when the price goes this high. And everyone's excited about it. And everyone thinks this. And the pullbacks and the drawbacks are huge, because the sentiment is way too, we're getting over our skis a little bit. You know, it takes a lot here to establish a Bitcoin reserve. There's still basics that organizations need to get in their heads around. How do they own this asset? You know, it's difficult to own Bitcoin if you're not going to buy a BlackRock IBIT ETF or one of the other ETFs. Why? I mean, how do you own Bitcoin? Yes, as technologists, we talk about, you can take it off the exchange and you hold it on a ledger stick, or you have a multi-sig wallet, and there's this like this, the 12 phrases on a piece of paper. It's the average investor finds that way too arcane, never mind the average institution. So how do you become a custodian of this asset? As you know, it's complicated. There's some, the blueprint is not clearly mapped out. Now, exchanges do have white glove services for organizations like that, but it's all so new. So risk has to look at it. I mean, I've sat on many boards and I still sit on boards. I'd love every single one of the institutions that I still sit on to go down the Bitcoin route. But the problem is, you've got to get the risk people on board. You've got to put in the governance procedures and map that to King and King 2 to make sure that you can be fully accountable. We still don't have maturity of tools. I mean, SARS right now, you know, they're issuing out licenses, cash licenses, right? So people that can become custodians and exchanges of Bitcoin in South Africa.
Explain that.
Yeah, so I love this, because essentially we are issuing licenses to folks like Valor, Luno, or any other entity that's a financial services entity that wants to become a provider of services for Bitcoin or crypto in South Africa. So those licenses are being issued. There's now extension to that. More licenses are being issued. A lot of licenses have been revoked. And this is great, because our regulatory framework is maturing. And we are finding that our regulators are climbing in and doing what we've begged them to do for years now. Give us the guardrails, give us the governance frameworks so we can comply and apply ourselves. I think this protects the consumer, so we don't have people selling Bitcoin and then you give them all the money and then they say you have the Bitcoin, but then they don't, and they do what FTX does and they go and do other things with the Bitcoin, or they use your funds to go buy some other silly crypto asset. So the avoidance of that is very good. So they audit you, they make sure you have the competence to actually house this license and give the service that you promised to give. This protects the South African consumer. But there's still immaturity in the space. You know, we still don't have the technological tools to truly do what they call proof of reserves. You know, to truly go and audit Vala or Luno and look under the covers and make sure in real time that the Bitcoin that you and I are buying, they are truly holding in cold storage like they promised, and they're not doing anything with it. You know, we can audit them periodically on an ad hoc basis too, but you know, do we have real-time tools to look into them all the time and make sure that they're not doing anything responsible? Those tools are maturing. I mean, I'm in fact investing in an organization, a technology company that's building these auditing tools. We're working with the Reserve Bank right now to educate them, to put a framework in place so they can have technological tools to audit exchanges. So example, right now, SARS has issued a warning about crypto assets, right? They say, you've got to declare it, make sure you tell us. If you don't, that's the only power that they have. Other than that, they don't have a real-time dashboard of tool sets to allow them to enforce the rules that they put in place. So that needs to mature up. So there's a lot of maturing in the industry that still needs to occur in South Africa and globally to truly have this asset on your balance sheet, managed, governed, and your risk and compliance folks at a board level are comfortable with it. So I'm okay that the no was given by Microsoft, but inevitably they'll come around and they'll just have to pay a little bit more for Bitcoin versus today. And by the way, I looked at it the other day. I have it somewhere here. Let's just take a look at this. I'm going to give you this. Right now, Bitcoin surpassed Saudi Aramco. So it is the seventh most valuable asset in the world. The next most valuable is Google. The next most valuable after that is Amazon. The next most valuable after that is Microsoft. The next most valuable after that is Apple, and then Nvidia. So we're not too far away. If we hit $150,000 a coin roundabout there, Microsoft will be very close to your cap, your market cap value. So, I mean, you put that into context, that's going to be quite interesting. I think they'll buy Bitcoin inevitably at a higher price.
Still a long way to go on that, and very interesting the point you make about SARS and the, you know, joining the dots. They've warned you, if you aren't disclosing it, we're going to nail you. Now they are regulating hundreds of exchanges or hundreds of people who are holding those Bitcoins. Part of the regulation, you got to report. Just to close off with, there's this company MicroStrategy. I mentioned it earlier. The reason why we invested it in the BizNews portfolio was because it is the biggest holder of Bitcoin in the world. And the idea was, well, if you want an exposure to Bitcoin, invest there. The problem was, when we looked at it again, the value of Bitcoin that it owned was about $35 billion. The value of MicroStrategy in market cap was about $80 billion. So you were paying $45 billion in hot air, in a way. It's a massive, massive premium. There is, however, another story to this whole MicroStrategy that some people are arguing for. Do you want to very briefly unpack that for us?
Yeah. Before we get to MicroStrategy, I'll just say what I'm very excited about is what's happening in South Africa from a regulatory perspective. I'm very excited about it. I'm excited about what certain individuals are doing at the Reserve Bank. Very smart people. I'm very encouraged by it. They're putting in the rails, etc. And I think not too long from now, they will enable the banking industry in South Africa to become custodians and holders and providers of services of crypto assets. The reason that's not happening is not because banks don't want to do it. It's because the Prudential Authority and all the legislative authorities can't manage that. They can't govern that. They can't hold them accountable to that. Those tool sets that will enable them to do that are maturing. And I'm involved in some of those discussions, and I'm very excited about what's happening there. South Africa, very, very beautiful thing happening there. For MicroStrategy. Now, the MicroStrategy, I love how Michael Saylor approached Bitcoin, right? So he started in 2020 and he looked at it because he had what he called a zombie company, right? So a zombie company is a company that is competing in a broader industry. In 2020, the Fed comes out, drops interest rates to zero. You got COVID stimulus. You're sitting with $500 million in the bank. It's going nowhere. And you're sitting at home. What do you do as a competitor to Microsoft? That was Microsoft. You have to go back and peel this from a first principles perspective and really listen to how this evolved for Michael Saylor. So he had a zombie company. Now, the Russell Index and all that is filled with zombie companies. People that have good businesses, they have stocks that don't move. They've got hundreds of millions, tens of millions in the bank. They've got a customer base, but there's no volatility. There's no interest in them whatsoever. That was MicroStrategy in 2020. What he then started doing is understanding Bitcoin. And this should be the evolution for all organizations. I recommend all organizations start looking at it in exactly the same roadmap of maturity way. He looked at it. The first thing he did was he read. He was in 2013 or 2017, he came out. 2017, I think it was a tweet where he said Bitcoin was going to zero. There's a tweet where someone put it up and said, hey, guess what? This is the guy that said Bitcoin's going to zero. That was Michael Saylor. And he said it's useless. It's nothing. In 2020, everything changed for him because he started studying. He said he was sitting at home and he started reading up on this thing. Then he got it. And the first thing that he did was he realized, wait a minute, this is a great thing to buy and hold for the business. So he exercised some capital and liquidity. Then he started buying. But as he's matured, and it's not Michael Saylor, it is actually, he's got great bankers, like incredible bankers. Because I think they call him every now and again and go, guess what? Why don't you enable this? And they keep padding on this next thing and the next thing. So what he announced was, you know, MicroStrategy is going to become a company that is a Bitcoin treasury. So I'm a Bitcoin treasury. Now, to understand what that means, you need to understand Bitcoin. If you don't understand Bitcoin, you're never going to get what he's doing. You really are not. You're going to struggle with it because you're going to look at it skeuomorphically again through your traditional economic lens. When you look at it that way, this looks like a Ponzi. You don't get it. It looks inflated. It looks like, what does he mean? You won't get it. You've got to go back to first principles, understand Bitcoin. Grow up the way he did. Now, you also have to understand the math. MIT graduate, aeronautical engineer. This guy is an engineer. He looks at everything through engineering lens and building a machine. That's his analysis of everything. So he looks at the machine and he says, I love his analogies because they're beautiful. And I'm just going to paraphrase him. He says, Bitcoin to everyone is volatile. It's volatile. He says, it's like fire, you know, and he says, when you are normie, you run away from the fire, like all the other animals. He says, but if you're Henry Ford, you take the fire and you put it into a horseless carriage and you change transportation for mankind, right? You harness the power. So he looks at Bitcoin's volatility and he loves it. He loves it. And what he's done is he's made it very clear that I'm going to become a treasury for Bitcoin. So I'm going to buy Bitcoin. And what I own in Bitcoin, if you want to buy Bitcoin, you can buy it through me. I'll sell you equity, and that equity sale, I'm going to take the proceeds from that, and I'm going to go buy Bitcoin. I'm going to increment the Bitcoin pile. And as the Bitcoin pile increments, there's some game theory here. The price will increase. I'm going to own more. I'm going to create more of noise in it. And my share price then goes up because I'm doing this. Bitcoin price goes up. And with the arb between share price going up, Bitcoin performance, he takes that arb and he buys more Bitcoin. And that's why he keeps saying, I'm just going to keep buying Bitcoin. So he becomes a mechanism for people that don't have regulatory rails to acquire the asset to buy it. So you go buy MicroStrategy equities, a security. So you buy a regulated security like you did. So you own Microsoft stock, a MicroStrategy stock. That's strategy, that MicroStrategy asset, that security is linked, in his opinion, directly to Bitcoin, which he's made it a covenant and a commitment to the market that he'll never touch it. So now there's a direct correlation. So as Bitcoin increases, and it's great when Bitcoin increases. Now, what he's also done, he's opened up, because of the volatility, he says he's taken Bitcoin's volatility as a nuclear engine, and he shoved it into his rocket. And he says, people run away from that, but he's going stratospheric, right? He's going to the moon, and he's doing it. So what he's doing is, he's taking Bitcoin's volatility and he's creating greater financial instrumentation were traditional market instruments around Bitcoin. You remember IBIT? You could buy IBIT, right? Then BlackRock applied and they got the options trading against your IBIT stock. So you could do puts and gets on your IBIT trade. So you could arbitrage and say, wait, so you could hedge yourself against it going down and you could, you know, there's no top, then you just grow with the top. He took that exact same model, the options trading model, and he attached it onto his security. So now he's enabled options trading on top of the platform. And more and more financial instrumentation are now the hedging, the puts, the gets, the arbs, how he's utilizing that. That needs to play itself out. I believe in him. I think he's done an amazing thing. And I think we're going to see more and more organizations doing this with Bitcoin. They're not just going to get strategic reserve assets. They're going to start plugging in these nuclear reactors into their businesses because it's hard money. Alec, here's the thing in closing. We've never had hard money. We are not used to having hard money. We don't understand what hard money enables you to do. We don't understand how hard money truly behaves. So we're getting used to this. So seeing somebody pioneering the usage of this substrate that is so hard, the scarcity that is so volatile and so purposeful, we're still getting used to what this thing truly is. And MicroStrategy is just another personification of its usage outside of the realms that we imagine. And it's very difficult to comprehend because we've got to go back to first principles. And the first principles is humanity has never had true scarcity and a digital commodity like Bitcoin. And these strange things that get done with it, we've got to get used to because we're going to see more and more of this happening. And I think Trump's going to do it on a nation state level.
Stafford, it's always fascinating. This has been one of the more interesting discussions that we've had. And my goodness, everyone is really interesting. Can't wait to see what you're going to come up with in March. Although by then, the whole world might have changed again.
It'd be amazing if I can announce Bitcoin Strategic Reserve by the United States. That'd be amazing. That's so much.
Bitcoin Strategic Reserve in South Africa. Why shouldn't those three, those tons, what do we have in South Africa? About... just over 173 tons being switched into Bitcoin at some point in time. I think we all understand a little bit better, and every time I talk with you, a little bit more on what Bitcoin is about. Rob Herzog, in a recent interview, said that his wife, who's a medical doctor, was not at all interested in Bitcoin. She spent 2 days studying it, and now she's the biggest Bitcoin protagonist you might imagine. And I guess that's what it's all about. Don't diss something until you've actually spent the time reading about it, understanding about it. And because that's the height of arrogance is to create an assumption or create a judgment on something before you've investigated it. So in this case,
I think as a South African, I think it's very important to understand this asset class, to comprehend it for your family, for you as an individual, especially if you're nervous about economics, if you're nervous about the politics, if you're nervous about South Africa, yes, you've got two options. You run to Magnus Aistek, who doesn't understand Bitcoin, and I keep trying to get him to understand Bitcoin. And he says, get the younger people to do that. You either run to him and you offshore some of your money, or you take control. You take control, and Bitcoin enables you to take that control, and it's a beautiful thing. And so as a South African, you've got a greater responsibility on your shoulders to understand this asset for you, for your family, as a young person, where you're going to store your value over time. It's Bitcoin. And don't get distracted by everything else that's a coin. Start with Bitcoin, stay there, focus, understand it, do the homework, and then decide whether this is for you or not.
Stafford Marcy, I'm going to give you one last little point to support what you said a moment ago. 2 years ago in Davos, I was at a Financial Times. Our partners invited me to a relatively small function they had. Neil Ferguson, who is well known as the writer, a great historian of the ascent of money, so he knows a heck of a lot about money, said that if you live in a volatile environment in a volatile country, you must have a big percentage of your assets in Bitcoin. That was his call. And he's so far, my goodness, I'll go up and shake his hand when I see him next time. Stafford, good talking with you. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.